So now we will, I'd like to, for you to meet and hear Bill A.F. Bill, I'm trying to find my... You got it? Yeah.
Hi, everybody. My name is Bill A.F., and I appreciate Gene very much, the send-off. About being talking about walking in the club, about changing the playgrounds and the playmates. This is the very first words that my father told me. And I felt just like Gene did. I didn't know what he was talking about either. I found out after a while, though, what he was talking about. When Gene opened the program a while ago, he read the preamble that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that we may share our common problems and help others to recover from alcoholism. Anytime a person walks into an AA meeting, or makes an AA call, they either expressly or impliedly ask two questions. And one of them is, what is it? And Gene has given this answer. Our forebears that wrote the big book back in the middle 30s designed this. And then the next question is, well, this is what it is. Now, how do you get sober? How many times has this question been asked? And how many times has this question been attempted to be answered? And even more nebulous than that, what is alcoholism? I might add at the outset, too, that I'm expressing my own opinions about this, because as the tradition is Tim said, what he read was out of the book. What I'm saying is out of my mind, my own opinions about it. But in this second question, to me, it is real important when they say how it works, because this is not, in my opinion, an edict of this organization or a mandate or a set of rules. Like I had to learn in the Boy Scouts. A scout is trustworthy and honest and thrifty and studious and so forth and so on. This is what 100 people said that they did, what they did to get sober. And as was suggested, they didn't say you had to do this. This is what they said they did, but they suggested it. Now, I have no way of knowing. I see a lot of familiar faces here. I have no way of knowing whether or not there's anybody in this room for the first time. I have no way of knowing whether or not there's anybody in this room who tried the program and failed to hear the answer to the second question of how does it work, and making the assumption that there are some that did not hear this the first go-around or the second go-around, I'm going to repeat it, because this is how our forebears got sober. Not necessarily how I got sober or Joe got sober or Tom got sober, but how the people who wrote our book got sober. It does and is, incidentally, the way I got sober. But chapter 5 out of the big book has been abstracted, and I want to read this again. I think it's really important, if for nobody's benefit but my own. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go, absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power, that one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We ask his protection with care and with complete abandon. And here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him. Praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order I can't go through with." Do not be discouraged. There is no one among us who has maintained anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. That we were alcoholics and could not manage our own lives. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And that God could and would if he was so. As I said before, this is the method that I chose. It was a great relief to qualify myself for a minute to find out it was alcoholism. I remember sitting on the side of the bed in the hospital one day, and I was going down the list of everything I knew: tuberculosis, measles, smallpox, chickenpox, pneumonia, appendicitis. leprosy, just about everything on earth, to find out that I was an alcoholic. This may sound strange to the man on the street, but to me, it was a relief to find out that it was something, because there was sure something wrong with me. You don't get in the hospital 5 times in 9 weeks just as another way of spending money. Get out of the hospital at noon on Monday, and by the time I could get back to the house, be falling down drunk, going through the front door after a week or 10 days of drying out. So when they told me it was alcoholism instead of leprosy or whatnot, I was relieved, really. I did not make my entrance into the rehabilitation of my life in this program initially through AA. I did all of my drinking primarily, and I sobered up in South Carolina. They have a state institution between Florence and Darlington, South Carolina, known as Palmetto Center, which is the state's effort towards rehabilitating alcoholics. You're admitted under what they call the Mayor's Committee. It's free of charge for those who can make a pauper's oath. Those that can pay have to pay. But this was my initial start towards the recovery of, or the arresting of this disease of alcoholism, which I was later to learn is something that's not, unlike pneumonia, is not curable. That today, I'm no further away from a drunk than I was the day I walked into that rehabilitation center. I know that if I take one drink of alcohol tonight, before I take that drink, I better get a 55-gallon drum of it and put it somewhere. Because it'd just be a matter of time, if it didn't kill me first, before I would be back into the depths or the plagues of a living hell, is the only way that I can describe it. And those of you who are alcoholics know well what I'm talking about. I want to digress a minute. I have my family with me tonight, my wife, Wanda, and the 3 children. And here not too long ago, they had a rerun of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Now, you know, about every 10 years, they remake this picture. It seems as though I recall this picture as the first time I saw it, perhaps at 10 or 12 years old. Lon Chaney played the part of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And then several years later, Frederick March played the part. And then several years later, who was the man? Can't think of his name now. I know Frederick March played the part. No, this was the last one. And I was going to say the last one that we saw that played the part was Jack Palance. But there was somebody in between Frederick March and Jack Palance. This is not important. The funny thing is, they were talking about they wondered what in the world Dr. Jekyll was drinking. And I found out what it was. It was a martini. This is what it did to me. I was a martini drinker. And this is just exactly the behavior pattern I took almost. I have always been interested in good reading. The subject matter, as long as I considered it wholesome, didn't make a lot of reason whether it was pertinent to my vocation or avocation or not. And in that way, I have, in some measure, accumulated several reams of unrelated knowledge. It's of no concern, for example, to learn how to run a submarine. All I do is just find out. But if I found a pamphlet on it, I might read the thing. But there has been one person all the way back to my high school days, for some reason or other, has always meant a lot to me, and that's Longfellow. He's written a lot of, here's a complete anthology of his work. Everything that he's written is within the confines of these pages. And there's one poem in there in particular that somehow or another, after sobering up and going back through this book, not this particular book, but back through his selected poems, somewhere along the line, I'm inclined to believe that Longfellow knew an alcoholic, or was one, or was in close association with one, because in the poem that I am just about to read covers this program so entirely that it just almost he had to have been one or known one real close. I know many of you have seen this. Back when I was in high school, as a matter of fact, I had to commit this poem to memory. This was part of maybe the junior or senior high school English literature. I'm not sure, but we had to commit this poem to memory. But it's, how many in here, I wish you would raise your hand, have read The Psalm of Life from Longfellow? It says A Psalm of Life, and then in smaller print, and I don't know whose print this is, but it says, what the heart of the young man said to the psalmist. Tell me not in mournful numbers, life is but an empty dream. For the soul is dead that slumbers, and things are not what they seem. Life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is not its goal. Dust thou art, to dust returneth, was not spoken of the soul. Not enjoyment and not sorrow in our destined end or way, but to act that each tomorrow finds us farther than today. Art is long and time is fleeting, and our hearts, though stout and brave, still like muffled drums are beating funeral marches to the grave. In the world's broad field of battle, in the bivouac of life, be not dumb like driven cattle. Be a hero in the strife. And this is where I think he knew the alcoholic. Trust no future, however pleasant. Let the dead pass. There it's dead. Act in the living present, heart within and God overhead. Lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime and departing leave behind us footprints in the sands of time. Here again in the next stanza of the alcoholic. Footprints that perhaps another, sailing o'er life's solemn main, a forlorn and a shipwrecked brother, seeing shall take heart again. Let us then be up and doing with a heart of any faith, still achieving, still pursuing. Learn to labor, learn to wait. So much of this has fitted into my way of life and the alcoholism that I went through. About 12-step work, footprints that perhaps another, sailing o'er life's solemn main, a forlorn and a shipwrecked brother, seeing shall take heart again. We sometimes talk about 12-step work. We've heard people say, I've heard people say many times, and I understand this, and there's no condemnation about it. They have said, I simply cannot, I don't have the whatever it is to go and knock on the door of somebody who's made a phone call and go in and take the program to them. I'm just not built that way emotionally. And they say, all that I can do is maintain my own sobriety. And if this paragraph don't cover this in total, I don't know what does. Just by simply saying no, sober, footprints that perhaps another can see. And of course, the last stanza fits us all to a T. Learn to labor and learn to wait. Especially learn to wait. Practically every source or fountainhead of information concerning either the etiology of this disease or the rehabilitation of this disease have generally agreed that we're compulsive people. That if we can't get it now, we want it yesterday. I saw a thing in the New Yorker magazine the other day. This fellow was standing in front of a clerk in front of a store. And the caption under there says, certainly I want it today. If I wanted it tomorrow, I'd order it tomorrow. Right now. Just don't wait till tonight and drink or tomorrow and drink. Right now. Let's just do it right this second. Right on the spot. This got me into a lot of trouble. Still have to fight this. This is part and parcel, in my opinion, of why I was impelled to put the quantity of alcohol that I did in my body. Alcoholism is a quantitative disease, among other things. That is to say that if we had in mind, we could have counted the ounces or gallons or pounds of alcohol that went through our body till we took our last drink. Nobody had any occasion to do this. Nobody does it. And I couldn't tell you today whether it was 100 gallons or 500 gallons or 5,000 gallons in my case, though I'm more inclined to believe it was 5,000 gallons. But it is a quantitative thing, and when I reached the point of saturation and reached whatever this factor is that is batted around like a shuttlecock in a badminton game, whatever this X factor or predisposing factor is that gets to where you cannot any further handle alcohol. Not that I think I ever handled it properly. Then you got to do something about it. And all the literature that I've read, again, says that if we don't quit, we've got three avenues. We've got two avenues if we don't quit. Either Baldwin County or death. The book says, the big book says, a spiritual awakening. I didn't have any blinding flash. But I did wake up one day in the hospital, and the doctor in attendance was making his rounds, and he came into my room with the nurse following him. And he looked at me and he said, well, you can go home 1 o'clock after lunch and go home. Dismissal time at this particular place was around 1 o'clock, ordinary situation. And he said, Bill, have you ever seen a hospital car? And I said, well, you mean those little metal things they've got stacked up out at the nurse's desk? He said, yes, that's what I said, no, doctor, other than just seeing the metal folder, I said, I've never gone into one. This is confidential information. You just don't pick up charts and start reading. And he said, Miss Smith, or whoever the nurse was, said, go get Mr. Foster's charts, and I want to write the final orders on it anyway. So she got the chart, and he flipped through this chart and got all the way down to the bottom, which was the initial sheet. That is the admitting sheet. And they had the usual information, next of kin, the name, address, and all this mess. Then down here, about item 25, it said admitting diagnosis. In other words, what did they think was the matter when I came in there? And there in print, that looked 5 feet tall when I looked at it, was chronic alcoholism. And I said, Sam, that's a terrible thing to put out there. I said, hell, everybody in the hospital is going to see this. And I'm going to turn this into the insurance people, and they're going to see it. And the first thing you know, this is just terrible. And he said, well, wait just a minute. And he flipped on over to the last sheet. And that was the dismissal sheet. And down at the bottom, it said words to the effect, what is the diagnosis on dismissal? In other words, did y'all get right? And he pulled this big old shape of pen out, you know, the kind that has the rubber bladder and whatnot in it, and writes in words 5 feet tall again, chronic alcoholism. And under that, prognosis was written. And he wrote out to the side of that, hopeless. And there again, I said, boy, that's an awful thing to be doing to me. I'll tell you, it's bad enough to put it in there in the front part, but this is awful. And he handed the chart back to Miss Smith and said, you go ahead about your duties. And he turned on and he walked on towards the door and he turned around and looked at me. And he said, you're nothing but a goddamn bum. Now, this was a man that we were friendly enough personally for me to just walk in at supper time and sit down and tell Mary to fix another plate. This is how close we were personally. And I said to myself, I was dressed, mind, just sitting on the side of the bed, in about as bad a shape from drug transference, from alcohol, that was fuzzy and woozy and whatnot, from all the drugs they'd given me to get me off the alcohol. And somehow or another, I managed to get up from the bed and walked over to the door, and looked up the hall, and he was walking up the hall, and I hollered to him, and he stopped. And I said, Sam, come here just 1 minute, please, sir. And he turned around and walked back to me, and he said, what do you want? The inflection of his voice had nothing in it but utter contempt. I said, what can I do about it? What is it? What's the solution? And then that's when he said, I thought you'd never ask. He said, there's a rehabilitation center for people who drink too much alcohol too often in Florence, South Carolina. Why don't you give them a ring and see? I said, well, I'd appreciate it if you'd make all the rings. He said, it'll never happen. You want to go to Florence? You make the arrangements. Well, I said to myself, well, I better not have any more to say to this fellow. I better just let it go at this. So one of the boys from, I was in the concrete business down there, came over from my plant and picked me up and took me over there. And I went in there and the office secretary, I said, Ms. Hughes, didn't you tell me that you were originally from Florence, South Carolina? And she said, yes. I said, I want you to attend to some business for me. How about calling the rehabilitation center up there and making arrangements for me to come up there and so on and so forth and so on? And she said, "Mr. Foss, I've always done everything you've asked me to do." I said, "That's right." And she said, "This is one time. No. If you want to make any arrangements about that place, you call them." And with that, she got up and got a purse and got in the car and went to lunch. I got so mad by then that I just picked up the phone in desperation. Now listen to this. Called the thing, and who answered the phone except the man that I needed to talk to? All the nurses were gone, the receptionists were gone, everybody was gone to lunch but the man that I needed to talk to. And he said, "I'll see you at 1 o'clock tomorrow." He said, "Have you been treated medically?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "By whom?" And I told him. He said, "I know this man because he is a, I can't think of the equivalent of a steward in the Episcopal Church. But this is what he was in his church, and this doctor in Florence was the same thing in his church." In other words, they had the same church affiliation, and they had never had any business professionally, but had been to a number of church gatherings, meetings, business together. I told him. He told me what to go by to that office and get, some certifications and whatnot. And I went on to the rehabilitation center. I got in there and I went through a battery of paperwork tests after having had a physical. I thought it never was going to end. Do you hate your mother? Do you hate your sister? Do you graduate from school? Why did you go to school? Why didn't you go to school? And all the questions that they asked. This went on for about a week. And after I'd been there about 2 weeks, the psychiatrist called me in and said, "Come on in my office." And he stood aside while he kind of just guided me in the door with my file in his hands, and he opened it up and looked at it and just closed it and said, "Have a seat. This won't take long. It's garden variety." Well, this made me mad. I thought I'd had a federal case for him to work on. And then he says, "Garden variety." He sits down and he starts talking about everything in the world except alcoholism. And I said, "Doctor," after a while, I said, "Doctor," I said, "this is all well and good," I said, "but what in the world has this got to do with drinking alcohol?" Said, "It don't have anything to do with it," he said, "but one thing that I've got to find out first." And I said, "What is that?" He said, "I've got to find out if you've got enough sense to know whether or not you've got enough sense. Because if you don't, you're in a hell of a fix." He said, "I've got to find out if you can understand what I'm fixing to tell you." And I said, "Well, try me." And he did right quick. It didn't take him, just like he said, garden variety. He told me the type of alcoholic I was, the kind I was. He told me that alcohol was supplying the missing pieces to my personality, that I could not compete in the society in which I traveled without chemical support. And that it was his opinion that if it hadn't been alcohol, it would have been something else. He said, "You got any other questions, Mr. Foss?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "It might interest you to know that I am an MD and I am a psychiatrist. I'm a past president of the American Board of Psychiatrists, and I am also an alcoholic and been sober in the AA program 15 years. And with that, he opened the door, and I walked out, spellbound, I guess is the best word to use. To me, this was the end of the line. I remember going back to the big, what we call the bullpen, where everybody didn't have anything to do. We were all flying menial duties, keep us busy. I washed dishes in the kitchen while I was there. Sat down and got some coffee and started meditating about this thing. And I said to myself at this time, there must be some better way to run this railroad than the way I'm running. There's got to be another way. Now, this takes some doing, and everybody in this room tonight who is sober knows exactly what I'm talking about. Because my usual defense mechanism, when this doctor at the hospital called me a bum, would be to start tearing into him physically. This would be my normal approach. But to stop, and for the first time in my life, listen to somebody else identify character defects that I had without getting mad enough to fight the person was something completely new to me. It was a new experience to me. Maybe this was a spiritual awakening. I don't know. I've never been satisfied yet by definition what a spiritual awakening is. Maybe this was it. I don't know. All I know is the first time in my life I did not respond with a fist. I responded with a question about what can I do about it. I also learned from this same gentleman later in some group therapy classes by one thing him making the statement about, he said, this is a strange thing. He said, you're here because you don't know what's the matter and you want to be rehabilitated. But the strange paradox about this disease as opposed to most any other disease is that it's a disease in the final analysis that only you alone can diagnose and that you alone can treat. And the day I left there, there were about four or five others that were leaving with me simultaneously, not going to the same town, but other towns in South Carolina. And he said, I've got a little bit of advice to give if you want to listen. If you don't, well, just go ahead. And everybody stopped in their tracks, especially me. He said, as soon as you hit the city limits of your town, your respective towns, he said, make an AA contact and then go home and unpack your clothes. Don't do it the other way. Don't go home and unpack. Then hunt up an AA contact. Don't do it that way. As soon as you hit the city limits, find AA. Then, when you get that business done, go home and unpack your clothes. I did this. It was real easy because my sponsor owns 11 liquor stores. This is a fact. He does. As a matter of fact, the first AA answering service was in the back of his number one store. And number two, he told me, he said, for those of you who are afraid to go home for fear that your peers and neighbors are going to find out that you have been in a state institution for the treatment of alcoholism, I've got another piece of advice for you. He said, don't brag about it, don't advertise it, and don't deny it. I do not want, and I never have, had any long-term, intimate contact with anybody that I don't inform them of this situation. This is just my own personal feeling about it, of letting them know that I'm an alcoholic. I do this. The rehabilitation center accomplished only one thing in my case. They told me first that there was such a thing as alcoholism. Number two, that I was in full bloom. And number three, that if you want to get well, you can do anything you want to. But like I got through reading a while ago, and the point in my reading, the second question, what do you do about it? The rehabilitation came about through this program and while we're gathered here tonight. I have gone through, those of you who are new in the program, I went through, of course, as I've said, the same sort of thing. I've made the jails. I even had the chief of police tell me that if he ever caught me in an automobile again driving, drunk or sober, he was going to lock me up. He didn't care what condition I was in. He just didn't want to see me behind the wheel again. The hospitals and whatnot. I've known what it is to be broke. I believe we were reading a poem the other day, one, and I believe who wrote James Whitcomb Riley, I believe, wrote the poem about what if you don't have a dime, being broke's not any crime, but keep a going. I've often looked back to this poem, too, when there was nothing else to go except to just keep it going. Wasn't anything else to hold on to. But through this program, I had been able to maintain the sobriety that was given to me. What I say providential, or what I consider providential, I don't think it's accidental. I consider my higher power, God, as I learned him in Sunday school. This is my higher power. I don't condemn or even evaluate whether or not somebody else has some other higher power or not. I've heard others express themselves that the group itself is sufficient for them, and that's fine with me. I just elected to use the God as I studied him in Sunday school as my higher power. And so far through today, I hadn't found it necessary to take a drink. I have also found out that the more active that I am in this program, the better off I am emotionally. We've talked about this many times. I'm sure many of you have heard it. But it's pretty difficult to fall out of the middle of a bed. You get into this program and get into the middle of it. Be active in it. Do what you can in it. It's pretty hard to get out. But you fool around with the edge of that bed. And sometimes you might get on that floor. I'm scared not to. This is where I found another life. Alcoholics Anonymous, when I say another life, Alcoholics Anonymous did not offer me a second chance at life. It offered me a chance at a second life. Because God knows I didn't want any more of the first one. I've had plenty of that. I didn't want to continue that route at all. And one day at a time, and this is difficult at times, we all have our problems concerning our own emotions, our own material gains that sometimes we feel are more important than other things. But we all have these problems from whatever source derives, and sometimes it's easy to get away. But one and I talked many times that it seems somehow or another we're more comfortable when we're more active in the program. And as I said initially, and as Longfellow said in the poem that I just read, that footprints that perhaps another, sailing o'er life's solemn main, a forlorn and a shipwrecked brother, seeing shall take heart again. I think this is probably the greatest first-step work we can do. It's changed the whole complexion of my family and everything else, simply by this alone. I want to thank Bob R. for asking me to come down here tonight. I've enjoyed being here. I've enjoyed seeing some old faces that I hadn't seen in a long time. One fellow in particular there come to find out we were working in the same town. Didn't even know it. So this is what I mean by staying close to the pole. We can better keep up with the what we are doing. And as Jim C. has said many times, when people have thanked him for going on the prayer step call, he said, "Don't thank me, I'm just about my father's business." Thank you and good night, Jim.